You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Tuesday, March 17th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of the practice of public health and director of the Center for Executive and Continuing Professional Education at the Department of Health Policy and Management, Harvard, John McDonough, will be joining us to discuss the death of single payer, question mark, and other sundried healthcare questions. Also on the program today, Israeli elections. Bibi Netanyahu has brought out the big guns. Yes, I mean John Voight. And what's his face again? The karate guy? Chuck Norris. Your mic needs to go up.
Chuck Norris.
Also on the program, what is human trafficking, abortion, and Loretta Lynch have in common? Well, we'll find out today in the Senate. Oregon has a new voter registration program. They've pioneered it. And Alabama, total disarray in the court systems there, because Alabamans apparently have such a problem with gay people, they can't even get their court system right.
I'll see you in your court next week. And,
a Ferguson coda, and Democrats angry at the classified briefings involved in the TPP, other trade deals that the president wants fast-track authority for. All that and more on today's program. But first, folks, let me say this, and this is a difficult... story to talk about. It's coming from the New York Times just moments ago. Well, actually, this is, I guess, 4 or 5 days ago. I just found it. Wall Street bonuses rose just 2% in 2014. And I know that a lot of you are saying, like, oh, only 2%, that's not very much. And you're right, but when you hear the dollar figure, you'll feel even a little worse. It is only went up $172,000. That's a bonus, incidentally. That's just the bonus. So we did some back-of-the-book numbers, and $172,000 represents almost... well, just a little bit more than one-fifth, or I should say five times the amount that we're looking for on our Indiegogo campaign. So for those of you who are crying in your spilt milk of bonuses that only tallied $173,000, which incidentally, according to this piece in the New York Times, of course, doesn't include compensation that was awarded for that year but not paid out yet, or... capturing stock options. So for your minimum $173,000, You can end our Indiegogo campaign today. We're 9% of the way there. So for still, let's just call it 1/5 of your bonus, you can end the Indiegogo campaign today for us. And we never have to talk about it again, ever. But if you didn't, and we'll come up with a perk for you too. I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know what you get. What do you get the Wall Streeter who's getting a $173,000 bonus and they're bummed about it?
I think they could get your life for 6 months.
I was
that would
say,
be a Sam Cedar half year.
I was going to say like a leather portfolio.
A leather portfolio. I think it would be great because
like
I...
Like a small, how about like a leather case for your smartphone?
I think of it in the same way that like Eddie Murphy did that routine about white people voting for Jesse Jackson as like a goof. Like they'd get drunk. Like there's some Wall Street guy right now who's like strung, like he's on X and he's hungover and he's just got his bonus. Like, I'm going to give money to this podcast. I'm going to get all their Indiegogo campaign for me, and I don't even care. I don't even like them.
Or I could just be like, I'm just going to pick one Indiegogo campaign and blow their mind. This one.
So, Ogle, hold on 1 second.
My favorite part about this, my favorite part about this piece, though, is second sentence, although still large by many standards. These bonuses grew far more slowly than in previous 2 years. Oh, sorry about that. So there you go. The Indiegogo campaign's going great. After 1 day, we have already got close to 9% of our goal reached. 9%. So we just need to have 11 more days like this one. Or we could have a day, you know, maybe we could get to 25% by the end of the day. That would be great. So head over to the Indiegogo. We got some great perks for you. Comedy DVDs, non-comedy DVDs, voicemail messages, hangouts, T-shirt. So check it out. We have our link at the front page of Majority .fm, or you can just go to Indiegogo.com and just search Majority Report. You'll find it. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, John McDonough. All right, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the program, professor of the practice of public health. One worked on the late Senator Ted Kennedy's staff in the development of the ACA in the Senate. Now at the director of the Center for Executive and Continuing Professional Education at Harvard, John McDonough. Welcome to the program, John.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So I've got a bunch of different questions that I wanted to talk to you about. About a year or so ago in Washington at the Families USA Health Action Committee, maybe it was a couple of years, we had talked at some length about the attempt by Vermont to pass a single-payer health care insurance system. That was basically they were looking for a waiver from the federal government. That was not going to be the problem. But in December, that effort basically ended. Why did it fail?
I think it failed because the governor came to the conclusion, Governor Peter Shumlin, after 4 years of studying and thinking and trying, that it was too heavy and too risky politically to move this forward. There were three studies that analyzed the finances and economics of doing this, and they were increasingly pessimistic in terms of how much the state would actually save at the end of the day. And the governor faced the prospect of asking the legislature to pass a new payroll tax on businesses of about 11.5% and a new income tax on individuals that would have gone as high as 9.5%, depending on income. And these monies would have replaced private health insurance premiums. But the level of support in Vermont, as evidenced by opinion polls and by other indicators, suggested that the public was sharply divided over this. And I think that, frankly, at the end of the day, the governor decided this was just too difficult, big, and risky a move for the state to take on by itself. And so he, in December, after 4 years of work on this, really pulled the plug and said they're going to continue to reform their system in other ways, but single payer will not be it.
And we should say that Shumlin was very politically weak coming out of this last election, right? I mean, he didn't even get to the runoff and had to more or less be elected via the legislature.
That's absolutely true. He ran against a Republican opponent who was vociferously against the single payer plan. Shumlin bested him in the general election, though only by 46% to 45%, tossing the election into the House of Representatives because nobody got more than 50%. And because it's heavily Democratic House of Representatives, he was elected easily, but not with a robust mandate that one could observe from the election results to move forward on this.
And so, is that it? I mean, a lot of people were looking to Vermont as sort of the, I guess in some ways, that was sort of the consolation prize that when the public option was exercised from the Affordable Care Act, the consolation prize was, well, Vermont is going to set up a single payer and we're all going to be able to look to Vermont and that's going to push it across the country. Is there any other hope for another state to go single payer, or is that just, is that ship sailed or sunk, or I'm not sure what the metaphor is?
Well, it's certainly true that when Vermont embarked on this in 2010 and 11, lots of folks who understood single payer and the politics of single payer said, you know, Vermont is really a terrific place to test it out because it is such a small state and so compact, and certainly seemed like a good place for a pilot for a state that wanted to move in this direction under the new authority permitted through the Affordable Care Act to bring significant new federal revenues into the state. And so when Vermont pulled out in December, you know, there's not another state you can look at this point where you can say single payer is actually a serious matter under consideration at the state level. You just don't find it anywhere. And so for Vermont to pull out is really kind of, you know, Vermont was the candle in the window for the single payer folks around the country. And now that candle's been blown out. You know, there are other states that have single payer bills, probably as many as two dozen, though it's hard to see one of them where you say, well, this is a serious policy option. I'm afraid, and I'm writing this in a piece that's coming out soon, that, you know, if there is a direction right now that makes sense where I could see something happening, though not in the short term, if you look at the federal government right now, the federal government is now managing three massive and separate programs to provide health insurance to various different groups of Americans. You have Medicare, which is actually two major programs unto itself. You have Medicaid.
And wait, we should just say Medicare is Medicare and Medicare Advantage.
Yes, that's right.
And that's covering about, what, 60 million people?
It's about 50 million now. Medicaid is now getting close to 70 million people. And then you've got, of course, the Affordable Care Act subsidies, which were expected in a couple of years to be up to around 20 to 25 million. You know, it just seems to me at some point in 5, 10, 15 years, you know, some people in both parties are going to say, you know, it's really crazy that we have these three massive governmental entities, agencies, to do the same essential thing, which is to provide health insurance or health insurance subsidies to different groups of Americans. I think that could be the significant step forward, because if that ever were to occur, it just becomes so much easier then as employers continue to fade out of providing health insurance for their workers, for there to be a new place which probably is not a single payer, but would provide much of the heft for the consolidation that the single payer movement is seeking.
But that consolidation, it seems to me, could go in two different ways, right? I mean, you could say, okay, we've got 20 million, 25 million people in the exchanges at this point. We've got 70, and probably by then, maybe closer to 80, 85 million in Medicaid, because presumably these states are going to slowly opt into the Medicaid expansion. We've got 50 or 60 probably by that point because of the baby boomers in Medicare. And so there could be, you could either go the Medicare model, let's say, or the Medicaid model, or you could go the exchange model, which is more almost like vouchers, it seems to me. I mean, is the exchange model not more like vouchers? I mean, explain that, because this is relevant. Let me just add this too.
This
is relevant because we now see the House. The Republicans in the House have come out with basically their annual attempt to cut Medicaid and to do Medicare in the form of vouchers. We don't know what the Senate's going to do. Less likely to follow them, but we'll see. So explain to us that relationship, vouchers versus the exchanges, and how that could go one of two different ways.
Well, so the exchanges are done through what are called refundable tax credits to subsidize health insurance premiums. If you want to call the exchanges a form of a voucher, I don't think you are being very inaccurate. I think you can make that case that this is a form of a voucher deal. But keep in mind, a third of people who are in the Medicare program right now are in the part of the program called Medicare Advantage, or Medicare Part C, where basically their enrollment in private health insurance plans is subsidized significantly by the federal government. And the truth also, in the Medicaid program, if you are the largest part of the Medicaid program in nearly all 50 states, namely if you are poor kids and their parents and non-disabled, non-elderly adults, for the most part, you're not in a Medicaid fee-for-service plan. You are in a Medicaid managed care plan already where your costs are subsidized. So, you know, the truth is that in all three of these major systems, the name of the game these days is the federal government subsidizes your coverage organized through some kind of a private managed care health insurance plan. And that's the reality of where we are today for people who have public coverage. The number of people with public coverage who are in any kind of a fee-for-service arrangement is shrinking and disappearing quite quickly.
But isn't the real question then is, do you maintain the cost containment benefits of a situation where you are operating the mechanism to pay the doctors?
There are different ways to manage that. That's a policy design choice, how you manage payment, how structured it is from the top. But generally speaking, when you go into subsidizing coverage through one of these private plans, for the most part, the private plans set the terms of payment of providers, which is honestly one of the reasons why providers actually tend to like these arrangements, because they get paid better under the private coverage arrangements than they do under Medicare or Medicaid fee-for-service.
Right, because the those private insurers don't have the same purchasing power or the same sort of data, I guess, readily available to them to say, to actually come to a rational price, right? I mean, that's why Medicare Advantage was so much more, was paying out, was reimbursing at rates that were far too high. That's why we needed to cut it back.
Absolutely. And here's a little surprise for you that I don't know if you've heard of, but one of the significant trends over the past 3 years now in the Medicare program and in the Medicare Advantage program is big provider systems, big hospital networks. I'm talking like Mount Sinai in New York and Long Island Jewish Hospital on Long Island in New York and elsewhere around the country. Large hospital and physician systems are starting to organize themselves as Medicare Advantage plans. So they're setting up their own private health insurance plans that are starting to participate in Medicare Advantage and in commercial insurance themselves.
But as an advocate,
yeah.
Speaking as an advocate of or someone who desires to see single payer, because I think the major efficiency is going to be in the cost containment of medical services, because you have one insurer saying, like, look, you know, we know how much we have the data to show that what kind of anesthesia, for instance, you should be getting your colonoscopy. I'll more on that in a moment. We can measure this across the country. And so this is what we're going to, and we know what's most effective. We've seen all the outcome data. How does, you know, like Medicare Advantage, let's say, is that as efficient as the other Medicare program? Why would we want to be subsidizing these private insurers as opposed to having a fee-for-based service?
The question of how much more or less Medicare Advantage costs from Medicare fee-for-service, traditional A or B, is a moving subject, because the Affordable Care Act significantly reduced the level of payments to Medicare Advantage insurers. And in fact, those rates are continuing to go down. And there's disagreement now among health policy experts. There are some who claim right now when you do an adequate risk adjustment and you look at apples to apples comparisons that in many parts of the country, Medicare Advantage is no longer costing more than fee-for-service and may actually in some situations be costing less. I think that's an unsettled question right now, because the game has shifted over the past 5 years because of the ACA, but it is far more competitive. The reason why it continues and grows, number one, is because it has very strong political support in Congress.
Right.
You know, the way to understand Medicare that I teach my students is, thing to understand is Medicare fee-for-service, Medicare A and B, the traditional part of Medicare, in general, Democrats love it and Republicans hate it. And you get then to Medicare Part C, Medicare Advantage, private insurance, and what you've got there is, for the most part, Democrats don't like it, many of them hate it, and Republicans love it and adore it. And that politically explains Medicare better than any shorthand I can offer you.
Well, I mean, well, but here's my point is that it seems to me the reason why we knew Medicare Advantage was overcompensating, was reimbursing at rates that were 15 to 20% too high, was because Medicare Part A and B provided the baseline.
Yeah.
So if it all goes to a Medicare Advantage model, let's say, as we move down the road and we have people in the exchanges, and the exchanges are sort of more, I think, are arguably more Medicare Advantage than Medicare. then we lose that that cost basis that we had from traditional Medicare, right? Or no?
And I wouldn't expect that to happen anytime in the near future.
Well,
I wouldn't expect us to abandon Medicare A and B, particularly because there are so many compelling innovations and experiments going on in it right now. I mean, if you are what's called an accountable care organization, a vertically integrated provider group authorized by the Affordable Care Act, you are participating in Medicare A and B. It's a fee-for-service phenomenon. And so I wouldn't expect to see. Now, I know Paul Ryan and the Republicans would love to get rid of A and B if they could. I no way expect that to happen. And you would have a revolt from seniors because there are still two-thirds of seniors at least who are part of traditional Medicare, and they're not going to want to see it go away.
All right. I mean, I guess, you know, again, I want to just remind people that we're framing this conversation in what could happen down the road as we find ourselves with the government essentially involved in the health insurance of, you know, close to maybe a little bit more than half the population of Americans. So you're not even including vets in that, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. You're getting closer.
And so at one point we're gonna sort of rationalize the system, and it's just the fight's gonna end up being: do we go more towards a Medicare Advantage system, or do we go more towards a Medicare system, which is sort of Medicare, you know, is either a single payer or a Medicare buy-in, which would be nice. Let's talk a little bit about what you see, what's happening this week. Let me just stop right there and just talk a little bit about healthcare containment, because over the past couple of weeks, really over the past couple of months, I've been trying to sort of schedule my own colonoscopy, and I finally got one. And I had had one 5 or 6 years ago because I'm at a higher risk because of family reasons. And the one I had had 5 or 6 years ago, the health insurance seems to cover all of it. I used propanol. They put me out, and it was, I have to say, one of the most pleasant experiences of my life, the propanol. But this time around, the health insurance company said, we're not going to pay for the propanol. You need to get a different type of anesthesia. And are you familiar with like this sort of this scenario seems to me to be at the sort of the heart of what we have in terms of cost containment in this country, because ultimately I had, I guess, some type of Demerol drip that my doctor was able to perform as opposed to the anesthesiologist who needed to do the propanol. At one point, I was going to be out of pocket $500 for this anesthesiologist, and I couldn't get a straight answer from the doctor or the insurance company, like, what do I need?
So I don't know about your specific situation, so I can't really comment on that, although what we are seeing across the board are innumerable examples of these kinds of contested arrangements and different ways that providers are treating and dealing with patients coming through for services in terms of who you get access to and what drugs, and it is a moving target and it is increasingly a mess. And it is something that really does need to be straight examined, fully understood, and Congress needs to step in to do a better job of protecting patients and protecting access to services. Unfortunately, they are still in a mode of simply trying to repeal the ACA as opposed to trying to address the legitimate issues behind it. My hope is that when we get into 2017 and President Obama's gone, whether you like that or don't like that, that the political furor over Obamacare will begin to significantly abate, and Congress, I hope, will return to their responsibility of doing serious oversight and improvement of places that are, in fact, driving American consumers crazy, like your example.
From your mouth to God's ears, John, I don't think so. I think they're just going to call it Hillary Care or whoever it is, and it's going to be that same problem. But
embedded in the system, seriously.
Well, I mean, what I found was this, as I Googled, is that apparently on the West Coast, most people get Demerol, 30%, 70%. On the East Coast, 60 or 65% get propanol. The propanol has to be administered by an anesthesiologist. The Demerol, only you only need your attending physician to do, who's doing the colonoscopy. The propanol is for doctors who want to do multiple colonoscopies or that many more colonoscopies in an hour because the person's laid out. They don't have to worry about providing the thing. The doctor is not going to be the one who's going to tell you this because they're going to say, like, well, I don't want to tell you that you're getting charged an extra $500 or I'm charging the insurance company an extra $500 so that I can maximize my profits. It's it's just unbelievable. And you know, I as a patient, I'm like, I don't feel the confidence to say I should get X or Y because I'm not a doctor. And it's unbelievable. I couldn't get the doctor to tell me. And basically, I ended up just, you know, it took literally a couple of months. And so, so let's move on from that just to a moment and talk about a deal that you have talked about, how the Affordable Care Act may be attacked this year. And we may, it doesn't look like it's going to happen, what you had written about a couple of months ago. But this week, the so-called doc fix seems to be on the docket. Tell us what the doc fix is, and tell us about this deal. I don't know if you have seen the latest, but so tell us about it.
So the doc issue, the doc fix, relates to a piece of Medicare law that was put in 1997 as part of the Balanced Budget Act. If any of your listeners remember that, when Bill Clinton was president, Trent Lott was majority leader in the Senate, and Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House. And it was put in as a way to try to control the growth of physician payment in the Medicare program known as Part B, which is mostly physician payments. And it basically said if the overall cost of physician payments stayed below a particular target, then doctors would get a bonus. And if it went above that target, then doctors would get dinged and their reimbursement from the program would automatically go down. And for the first few years, doctors actually came in less than target and got these bonuses. So they were very happy with this. And beginning in 2002 and 2003, they started going in the other direction. And the first year in 2002, Congress let the penalties go into effect. And doctors were massively pissed off all over the country and just enraged at Congress. So every year since then, 2003 and beyond, when the costs go up above the target, Congress comes in at the last minute and does what's called a doc fix, where they prevent the cuts from going into effect. But the cost of these keeps going up year after year after year, and Congress has been unable to come up with a long-term solution, mostly because they can't figure out how to pay the big cost of doing it. And so Congress over the past year, Republicans and Democrats, have come together unbelievably and come up with what's a fairly smart reform package to replace SGR. What they have not been able to agree with is how to pay the roughly $150 to $170 billion cost over 10 years, because Democrats would pay for it one way, Republicans another. They can't agree, and then a stalemate happens and they go back to another doc fix or another patch. So right now, heading to the next, what's called the SGR, the doc fix cliff, comes on March 31st, and it looks like the leaders in the House and the Senate, with the Democrats, are agreeable to doing a permanent SGR or doc fix, and essentially not financing the $150 to $170 billion in cost, and instead adding it to the federal deficit. But the truth is, that money would be spent anyway, because Congress will never allow these payment cuts to go into effect. I think this is a smart thing to do. I think it's long overdue to get rid of this albatross, which, by the way, was the concoction, the creation of Bill Thomas, the Republican chairman of the House of Representatives in 1997 when they did this. Very complicated to most Americans. Most Americans just roll their eyes and can't understand what it's about. but it's a big issue, and it seems that Congress may finally be on the verge of fixing it and getting rid of this.
Okay, I have two questions. One, by just outlaying the cash, do we lose any of the benefit of cost containment at all, or we just have basically given up that?
Well, there's no way, only on paper, because the truth is there's no way that Congress is going to permit these kinds of cuts to actually go into effect.
No, I understand that politically speaking, they can't withstand the power of a bunch of angry doctors.
Yes,
but,
correct.
But with that said, though, it was ostensibly set up to basically to control the growth of medical costs. Are we we basically just saying that apparatus, we're going to scrap it?
Well, we would scrap the SGR. We would scrap the flawed payment system, but put in its place a new set of measures and reform mechanisms that frankly hold a greater promise of actually accomplishing something than the SGR was ever able to do. So if they can do it, I honestly believe this is a good deal for physicians, this is a good deal for the Federal Treasury long term, and it's a good deal for consumers and patients.
Now, my understanding, one of the deals I've seen on the table is that perhaps they would basically change the mean testing formula for Medicare.
They would charge higher premiums for higher income seniors, yes.
Yeah, so that's part of the deal as well.
Yes, that would be one of the ways that they finance just a small piece of this law. And this is seniors who are...
You make over $133,000 and $266,000
right.
for a couple. You would be responsible for 65% of your costs as opposed to 50%.
Right. And I'd rather not do that. However, it's a relatively small proportion of seniors who are actually making that amount of money. And so it seems to me like it's probably worth the trade-off.
That's income, we should say.
Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
So it's not. I mean, I guess at that, if you're making that at that point, I guess you're talking about basically 15% more responsibility for your co-payments. We should say that obviously Medicare is already means tested in that respect.
Yes, it is. Most people don't understand that. You're absolutely right.
All right. So one more thing I want to just touch on, too, because this is going to be in the news over the coming weeks. We don't know what the Senate Republicans are going to come out with, but we know what the House Republicans are going to come out with. They want to cut Medicare by voucherizing it, which we've already touched on to a certain extent. That's basically, it's not fee-based. It's basically you buy your private insurance and we give you a check to buy your private insurance. The concern there, of course, is that the cost of private insurance is going to go up at a rate faster than the size of your voucher subsidy. And you may be saving the U.S. government this money, but normal average Americans not making $133,000 a year over the age of 65, they're going to have to pay more and more for health insurance. That's the problem with vouchers.
Absolutely. Well, that's the problem with the way they want to do vouchers. You could do vouchers in a way that doesn't leave people at risk in that way, but that is their strategy.
All right. So tell us, what's the problem with block grants for Medicaid?
Well, block grants for Medicaid means that instead of guaranteeing that states have the set money to cover the medical needs of the Medicaid population, the federal government just sets an arbitrary limit and says, here's what we're going to give you, do the best you can. And then they give states the authority that they don't have now in the same way to cut benefits, to cut eligibility, to cut all manner of protections that low-income Americans need in terms of making sure that the Medicaid program works for them.
And what kind of controls when they block grant that money? Like you say, it's arbitrary and it doesn't take into account the need. It just takes into account of like what we want to give you, which is sort of contrary to the point of Medicaid on some level, it seems to me. But how much flexibility also, if you wanted to get creative on the state level and divert some of that Medicaid money when it comes in as a block grant, it's not too tricky to do that either, is it?
No, and so it all depends upon how these rules would be written. However, the point of view of the Republican leadership in Congress is that they would love as much as possible to just give checks, give states a check and say, do what you want. And what we've seen in terms of the ACA implementation is that there are obviously many, many states that really don't care in terms of their governmental leadership about meeting the health needs of their citizens. There's 22 states that have yet to expand the Medicaid program as permitted under the ACA with 100% federal financing. I mean, there are states with that they won't expand health coverage to their poorest citizens even when the federal government pays the whole cost. And so the notion that you're going to then give these states a check and say, do your best for the people, I think the ACA experience proves that to be a severely risky and damaging proposition for our neediest fellow citizens.
Now, lastly, I just want to touch on King versus Burwell for a moment. I know that in the course of helping develop the Affordable Care Act, you were one of those people who said you were in the mix. You said nobody ever contemplated the notion that a state that decided to have the federal government establish the exchange for them wouldn't get its people who opted into the exchanges, its citizens, wouldn't get subsidies, because that's ridiculous. That's like it's like building a car without an engine. But what? Give me a sense of, in the event that the Supreme Court rules in favor of the plaintiffs and decides that these states, by not establishing their own exchanges, are not ineligible for subsidies. What are potential fixes for that?
Well, it's interesting. There's a column in the New York Times today that actually suggests that if an adverse ruling were to come down from the Supreme Court, the Obama administration could simply say, we will agree then not to charge penalties from the individual mandate for the four individual plaintiffs and nobody else.
Huh.
So there are a lot of – I'd advise you and your readers to take a look. I want to hear some reaction and commentary about it, but we will see what happens. This lawsuit is one of the more preposterous things I've ever seen get to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I don't think it has much legitimacy from a legal perspective. This is unfortunately a reflection of the politicization of the Supreme Court, as we've seen in Congress and elsewhere in American society. My hope, though, is that the oral arguments were convincing enough that that we won't see this move forward, and this will be the end of it in June.
Well, I was down there, covering this outside the Supreme Court for a couple of days, talking to a lot of legal experts, and that is a novel approach in just addressing those four plaintiffs. But my guess would be that then you'd start to see other circuit courts say, like, no, depending on the circuit court, you can't. This is just as it was for those four plaintiffs, even if they weren't actually the best of plaintiffs. I mean, but from a fix from the government standpoint, what could they do? Could they simply say, could the federal government say, like, to states that were willing, look, you buy the exchange for us for a dollar, and we charge you $1 a year to administer it, and it's yours. I mean, could they say that? What else could they do?
It depends. Part of it is it depends upon the nature of how the ruling would be written.
Okay.
They could say they could give time for implementation. Congress could come in and fix it with a one word bill.
Right.
There are many different options. I think the thing to be hopeful for at this point is that the Supreme Court will see it in a way that is protective of this important benefit for so many Americans who need health insurance. And there are many, many different ways this can go, and I wouldn't jump to conclusions at this point.
Okay. Well,
expect to be surprised.
John McDonough, thanks so much for your time today. I genuinely appreciate it. And people can check out your book entitled Inside National Healthcare.
inside national health reform.
Health reform, yes.
Yeah.
All right, we got a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks again, John.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, there it is. I promised you all as a reward for us exceeding 8% on the Indiegogo campaign that we would go in depth in some healthcare policy. What? What an amazing sell. You think I'm crazy?
You're a self-inflicted wound sociopath.
Why? Why? I don't. How could I think people?
No, people
I think
love
people,
it.
I think
this
that
is a very smart audience.
Yes, I mean the people who listen to this audience have an understanding of hopefully of healthcare and healthcare reform and how it works. I mean, obviously, if you're involved in that field, you have a baseline set of knowledge. But if you're not, there's nobody on the bus as you're looking around on the bus today or on the subway or at your, you know, coffee shop that's going to know more about this stuff than you.
Your friend is looking at pictures that Kanye tweeted out of Kim.
That's
and
right.
You're saying, yeah, well, maybe the ruling will just only apply to those four people.
That's right.
How about that? And then they're like, what are you talking about? And you go, Keaton versus Burwell. And they go, what is that?
Right.
And you say, you are a moron.
That's right.
I'm going to go contribute $10 to the Majority Report Indiegogo campaign.
Right. And then I'm going to go over and I'm going to go to podcastawards.com and I'm going to vote because I just found out that you don't have to wait 24 hours. You can do it every calendar day. So now whenever there's music on the Majority Report, it reminds me to go vote for podcast for Majority Report at podcastawards.com. There you go, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you ever thought about becoming a member of the Majority Report, now's a great time to do it. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. If you buy crap on Amazon, go to MajorityReportKickback.com. Support the program. You can IM me through the app at majorityapp.com. Get the app. It's iOS or Android ready. You can one-touch IM me. You can listen to the show, stream the show, download the show, listen live. Ah, it's so great. You can IM me at the Majority FM on your AOL Instant Messaging or any other client. All right, folks, back in a sec.